Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for an intelligence briefing on what I think of as the war for the free world. We often think about that war in kinetic terms. Much of it is fought in that fashion. And yet, there is a whole nother front that is extraordinarily important to the future of our republic, and it's being waged in a manner that is not kinetic, exactly. It is being conducted by diplomats, or people who simply have an agenda that they are pushing through in various forms, many of them taking the shape of treaties or international agreements. One of the country's preeminent authorities on this kind of lawfare, I think it's fair to call it, is Ted Bromond. He is a senior research fellow in Anglo-American relations in the Margaret Thatcher Center for Freedom, which is part of the Heritage Foundation. Ted formerly was an associate director of Yale University's International Security Studies Program. He writes widely on these matters, and it is an extraordinary treat to have him with us for a full hour to talk about how our Constitution and rights and security are being influenced and perhaps even imperiled by something that seems innocuous, international treaties, many of which have the kinds of names or titles that are superficially very appealing. Ted is here to help break this down for us, and we're very grateful to him for taking the time. Ted Bromond, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thanks, Frank. Really great to be back with you and your listeners.
Thank you. Listen, let's start with the nature of international treaties and how they relate to our Constitution and what considerations prompted our framers of the Constitution to try to safeguard it against the possible, infringement by such international accords.
Well, the founders understood the treaties were a very important way for nations to do business with each other. They weren't altogether against the idea of treaties. Of course, that's why the Senate has such an important role in ratifying them, or if you want to be really accurate, giving its advice and consent to them. But they recognized that precisely because treaties were so important, they had to be negotiated carefully, and they had to be controlled through this process of Senate approval, so that the government of the day couldn't just agree with a foreign government to do anything it wanted to and then force it upon the United States without some sort of approval. Now, that approval, of course, comes through the vote, the advice and consent of the Senate. We've also realized later on that if you really want to implement a treaty inside the United States, you need to pass laws for it. In most cases, you simply can't have just a treaty. And, of course, to pass a law, you have to have the House of Representatives, the Senate, and the President all agreeing to it in normal circumstances, presuming that a veto isn't overridden. So treaties, the founders recognized, were a very important way for the United States to do its business internationally. Treaties really are the way that civilized nations deal with each other, and that's a very good thing. But the treaties also represent something that we should all treat as extremely important. It's the promise of the United States. It's really, if you want to be old-fashioned about it, it's the honor of the United States pledged internationally to do or not do a certain thing. And precisely because that's so important, it has to be controlled through the democratic lawmaking process. It simply can't be given over to the executive branch, to the President of the United States, for him solely on his authority to pledge the word, the promise, and the honor of the United States to do or not do something.
Yeah. And Ted Bromond, there are sort of two pieces to this. The Constitution, as I recall, describes treaties as the supreme law of the land so that they establish their preeminence. And the courts of the United States are able to enforce our treaty obligations. So this goes back to what you've just said, which is the architects of our republic had in mind a very rigorous set of checks and balances to ensure that this kind of process was not abused by people who, in the executive branch or, for that matter, in foreign governments who wish to do ill to our constitutional procedures and practices and rights.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. And it's really a measure of how seriously the United States takes treaties that we have this entire system. You sometimes hear people on the left say, oh, the United States doesn't really take treaties seriously. We don't really care. We haven't ratified this treaty or that treaty, and that shows that the United States just isn't interested in treaties. Well, that's really absolutely untrue. In fact, it's the reverse of the truth. The United States sometimes doesn't ratify treaties precisely because we do take treaties very seriously, and that's a good thing. We shouldn't just give the word of the United States to any casual promise that happens to walk by. As you point out, treaties are, once they've been signed and properly ratified, enforceable law inside the United States. Now, that means that we take them seriously in a way that virtually no other country in the world does, because not many other countries treat treaties inside their own country as enforceable law. For most countries, treaties are simply a vague international promise to do or not do something. For the United States, they really are, after the entire process of the Constitution has been followed, they really are our law. And that's precisely why it's important for the United States to keep on doing what it's done for a long time, which is to treat treaties as serious international documents, but documents that can also profoundly and legally affect people inside the United States. It's really two sides of a coin. If you want to be serious about international diplomacy and treat treaties seriously, as we should, we also have to recognize that because they're enforceable in the United States, we really shouldn't just sign and approve everything that happens to wander across the president's desk.
Let me drill down on this. And again, our guest is Ted Bromond, the Senior Research Fellow in Anglo-American Relations at the Heritage Foundation's Margaret Thatcher Center for Freedom. Ted, there are several pieces of this, and we're going to get into specific examples of how these practices and processes are often, it seems, increasingly abused. But just to stay with kind of the macro level for a moment, talk a little bit about how, as you say, if the normal constitutional process is followed, then these treaties become enforceable in our courts, for example. But it seems as though, even if they're not followed, even if we have a president simply signing a treaty, as you say, something that comes across his desk, and doesn't send it to the Senate for its advice and consent, and there is no implementing legislation that brings the House of Representatives into it, we nonetheless find ourselves bound by these treaties, or as they now are calling them, international norms. Explain that a little bit, if you would, how that works.
Well, let me zoom out just a little bit more and talk for just a second about the way the founders thought about treaties. If you go back to John Jay's Federalist Essay on the Powers of the Senate, he discusses treaties as simply a contract, and he really means it in a very business-like kind of sense. You know, if you and I do a contract in the business world and I break it, you're no longer bound by the contract. The founders thought of treaties as contractual documents. The United States agreed to do or not do something, provided the other nation did or didn't do something in the treaty. And if the other nation didn't live up to its deal, then the obligation on the United States just disappeared. It was as if the contract had never existed.
Null and void.
Null and void, absolutely. You know, if you and I agree to do a deal and you're going to sell me 1,000 pounds of cucumbers and I'm going to give you some money for them, and you don't turn up with the cucumbers, I'm not obliged to give you the money. I mean, that's sort of a very common sense understanding of treaties. Now, unfortunately, we in the United States and the rest of the world has moved away from this understanding of treaties as contracts towards an understanding that treaties are binding on nations even if the other side is cheating or not upholding them. And that's really where we are with a lot of treaties today. This is especially true in the human rights treaty realm. Human rights treaties are conceived of as sort of promises to heaven by a nation, not actual legally enforceable treaties that are contracts between one nation and the next. Now, you know, trade treaties, in some cases, arms control treaties, are still thought of sort of as contractual documents in some cases. But human rights treaties, which are all of the most controversial treaties nowadays, I think are fundamentally human rights treaties. Human rights treaties aren't contractual.
And aren't being honored by the other parties in case after case after case. We have to pause for just a moment. We'll be right back with more with Ted Bromond of the Heritage Foundation. In particular, we're going to drill down on some of the treaties that are so problematic at the moment, human rights and otherwise, with Ted, including the UN Arms Trade Treaty. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them,
when you make fun of them,
when you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around. And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Michael Medved says stupidity in our federal government is a bipartisan issue.
This administration and the leadership of Barack Obama
and the leadership of some folks in the Republican Party
are both so stupid and just so inane and brain dead. Can you see some kind of bright side here?
Stupid is, stupid does, sir.
The Michael Medved Show.
You want to help me with this?
Afternoons from 3 to 6 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved, and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back visiting with a distinguished scholar and, well, national security practitioner of a very black art. That is
the business of lawfare and how it is being waged against the United States by people who do not have our best interests at heart, it turns out. They are wielding tools known as international treaties and agreements and norms for the purposes, it seems, of, hamstringing us, perhaps, undermining our constitutional form of government or, worst, our liberties. And he is, of course, Ted Bromond, a senior research fellow in Anglo-American relations at the Thatcher Center for Freedom of the Heritage Foundation. He is also a columnist for Newsday and Great Britain's Yorkshire Post. You also will find his writings frequently at Commentary and Fox News. Ted, I had to interrupt you there. I apologize for that. But just finish your thought on how this practice of, basically contractual arrangements has mutated over time to the point where now even things called international norms are somehow unilaterally binding on this country, but not on others.
Sure. Well, there are really two facets to that. The first is what happens when the president signs a treaty, but it doesn't get the advice and consent of the Senate. The United States has adopted the idea that even if the president hasn't sent the treaty to the Senate, even if the Senate has never voted in favor of it, that the U.S. is still bound not to defeat the treaty's object and purpose. This idea has been used to move the United States into a position where, practically speaking, it ends up almost complying with treaties that the Senate has never actually approved. And this is not something that goes on for a month or a year or a couple of years. This is something that can go on for decades at a time. It's really a process that just defeats the entire Senate advice and consent system.
It does, and to the extent that what we were finding is that senators are going along with it, it is truly a transformation of not only the constitutional processes that you've been describing, Ted Bromond, but also, of course, of the kind of check and balance that the founders had in mind against executives engaging in this vehicle for mutating our system of government and the rights of Americans. Ted Bromond is our guest. We're visiting with him from the Heritage Foundation about this practice of changing how we conduct ourselves, notably but not exclusively internationally, by virtue of treaties that have been, in some cases, not even submitted to the Senate for its advice and consent. And one of those that you have studied intensively and been warning of for years, Ted Bromond, is the so-called UN Arms Trade Treaty. I'm delighted to say that the Second Amendment Foundation conferred upon you in 2013 its Scholar of the Year Award for your analysis of this treaty. Tell us a little bit about this particular product of the United Nations, and then we'll get into a little bit of its implications.
Well, the Arms Trade Treaty began over a decade ago when a large number of NGOs, non-governmental organizations, all of them explicitly on the left. You can find documents online quite easily when they describe this as an effort to create a progressive, quote-unquote, document. And we all know that progressive is a code word for left-wing. And the advertising bulletin behind the Arms Trade Treaty was that it would be a way to stop terrorists and dictators from getting their hands on weapons. And by the way, this isn't just small arms. Sometimes the treaty is mistakenly referred to as the UN Small Arms Treaty. It's actually about everything from revolvers all the way up to battleships, everything except WMDs. And it sounds like a very appealing idea not to let terrorists and dictators get their hands on weapons, but you really have to ask the question of who is arming terrorists and dictators in the first place. Well, it tends to be places like Iran, China, Russia, Pakistan, Gaddafi's Libya, North Korea, lots of places that really have no respect for treaties whatsoever. So if you thought about it for about 5 seconds, you'd realize that you're not going to stop terrorists from getting their hands on guns by adopting a treaty because Iran's not going to pay any attention to it. So the real covert motivation behind this treaty has always been to focus on the arms sales of the United States, a few other Western countries, mostly in Western and Central Europe, and on Israel. That's the real target of the Arms Trade Treaty, just as several previous treaties, the Cluster Munitions Treaty, the Landmines Treaty, ended up being caused and focused mostly on the United States and Israel, even though we are not the culpable ones.
Right. And again, this is where this concept of lawfare comes in. It is a means of imposing restrictions, as you say, Ted Brahman, on the United States unilaterally, asymmetrically, and on its ability to protect its friends and allies and interests by transferring weapons. Describe the mechanism by which this might operate against, say, a U.S. effort to resupply Israel in the face of the kind of depletion of its armaments that resulted from the campaign it had to wage to protect its people against Hamas last summer.
Well, at the core of the arms trade treaty is the idea that nations are supposed to have a process for controlling the export of arms. Now, the United States does have this process. It's widely regarded as one of the best, if not the best, in the world. And even advocates of the treaty recognize that the U.S. does have this sort of process. But what the treaty says is that nations are supposed to consider two things, among others, when they export arms. International humanitarian law, this is the newfangled term for the laws of war, and international human rights law. Now, unfortunately, these terms have no precise meaning. If you go off to international lawyers and you ask 20 of them, they will each give you 20 different definitions of what are permitted or prevented by these two standards. So what the United States has done in signing on to this treaty is put itself on a conveyor belt. And the conveyor belt is run at a speed and to a direction that we simply don't control. We have signed ourselves up to obey an ever-evolving standard of international law that we really have very little control over. So when the Israelis ask for resupply in some future conflict, an administration could look at this treaty and say, you know, the UN has accused the Israelis of human rights abuses, and the UN always accuses the Israelis of human rights abuses. Well, we think that resupply to the Israelis is forbidden by the arms trade treaty. I guarantee that that will happen in Europe. In fact, the UK government is already being sued by human rights organizations precisely to force it to break all of its armament contracts with Israel. And what happens in Europe, unfortunately, happens about 10 years later here in the United States.
Going back to what we talked about, as you say, a legal instrument that can be enforced in federal courts if one finds a federal judge willing to intervene. Is that not so?
Oh, and you know, I guarantee that that will happen in this case, because it's already widely accepted under the Arms Control Export Act that the federal government has the power to control the export of guns and every other weapon from the United States. And under the Gun Control Act of 1968, it has the power to control the import of firearms and other weapons into the United States.
We have to pause for just a second, Ted Brahman. I want to very, very closely examine the implications of this arms trade treaty that the UN has just cooked up and President Obama has signed, but is not apparently intent on submitting to the Senate for its advice and consent for, among other things, our own Second Amendment freedoms, the constitutional right to own and bear arms. That and more with Ted Brahman of the Heritage Foundation straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Yesterday, two mortar shells fell within 500 meters of the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. they should be the shots heard round the world, or at least in official Washington. After all, the mortars were presumably fired by Islamic State jihadists. These attacks are sure to be followed by more, and more accurate ones aimed at America's largest overseas diplomatic complex. At that point, the thousands of U.S. personnel assigned to Embassy Baghdad may well be sitting ducks if, as seems likely, these jihadis are able to sever their sole remaining evacuation route, Baghdad International Airport. It seems prudent now to begin doing two things. One, beefing up our military's ability to project power regionally, well beyond the pinprick airstrike seen to date. And two, decreasing the number of Americans at risk in Iraq. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at
them. When you make fun of them.
When you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around.
And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We're having a very special and, I think, very important conversation with one of the country's preeminent authorities on matters involving international law and the extent to which it is used as a weapon, really, against the United States, designed to disarm us or disable us or otherwise to undermine our interests around the world, our capability to protect them, and not least, I'm afraid, in some cases at least, our rights here at home. He is Ted Brahmand. He is a highly regarded scholar and now the senior research fellow in Anglo-American relations at the Margaret Thatcher Center for Freedom, part of the Davis Institute for National Security and Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation. Ted, again, thank you for taking this full hour with us to really explore these issues that you are so deeply knowledgeable about. It's a treat to have a chance to do it at length. You were just making a point about how this UN arms trade treaty might impinge upon our Second Amendment freedoms, the right to bear arms. How would that work and why?
Well, it can work in a couple of ways. Proponents of the treaty will invariably say that it can't have any impact in the United States. And that's just untrue. The U.S. firearms business is extraordinarily international. A lot of major U.S. brands are foreign-owned, foreign-manufactured, and every significant firm has got an international parts and components, supply and financing chain. So you really can't wall off the U.S. firearms business from the rest of the world. And that, unfortunately, is the point. Because we're already starting to see NGOs saying, the kind of organizations that supported this treaty, saying, well, other countries should stop supplying the United States if it doesn't, A, approve the arms trade treaty, and B, do all the other things that we think it should do. So what could very easily happen is that other countries could decide that our firearms chain in this country should be disrupted because they're not going to export to us anymore because of the arms trade treaty. That's one way the treaty can affect us. A second way is that the treaty creates the obligation for governments to prevent what is known as diversion. And diversion essentially is when a weapon of any kind moves from an authorized person to an unauthorized person. That's a very wide-ranging obligation, and it can very easily be read in the treaty as applying inside the United States as well as to U.S. arms sales overseas. So there are plenty of mechanisms for this treaty to affect the ability of individuals inside the United States to make use of their Second Amendment freedoms.
And so, Ted, to recap, you could see Americans' rights under our Constitution to bear arms infringed upon because manufacturers of components of firearms sold in this country may come under pressure or under court orders, foreign or domestic, to preclude the sale of those components to the manufacturers. And that, of course, is presumably a very much intentional part of this international campaign that has tried to force us to conform to, as you say, what other do-gooders, or international human rights activists and what have you, have long thought we should do with respect to gun control inside this country. And of course, they have their counterparts and admirers and supporters and fellow travelers inside this country who've been seeking for many years, as you know so well, Ted, in the U.S. Congress to get gun control mechanisms of various kinds, but they haven't been able to succeed. And so this really amounts, this kind of lawfare amounts to a backdoor means of enforcing these ambitions where they couldn't otherwise get them approved.
Well, you know, we gays, that is the treaty skeptics, myself and many other people, very knowledgeable people, went to the treaty proponents several years before the treaty was finalized, and we gave them some very private advice. We said, listen, you know, if you will include in the treaty an absolutely ironclad statement saying that this treaty has no application whatsoever to domestic firearms ownership, manufacture, use, possession, or anything else for purposes of self-defense, sport, or any other legal purpose, we would have to recognize that it would be very much more difficult for us to oppose this treaty. So why don't you think about including this clause? And we were absolutely roundly rejected. Now, you tell me, if a treaty really is not supposed to affect domestic firearms, manufacture, sale, possession, etc., then why didn't the treaty proponents take our advice and just include this clause? According to what they say, it wouldn't have hurt them at all.
What we are confronting and what, you know, your efforts have really exposed, Ted Brahmand, is the fact that these guys are absolutely hell-bent on not only restricting our ability to supply arms to our friends like Israel, and for that matter, I guess it would apply to the president's efforts to support the so-called moderate rebels in Syria, but also to reach inside this country. Let me just ask, Ted, where are we now with respect to this treaty? I know a review conference or some such thing happening in Mexico. And what role will critics like you be able to play there?
Well, as you referred to earlier, Secretary of State Kerry signed the treaty on behalf of the United States last fall, September 25th, 2013. And the treaty now has 50 national ratifications. Of course, the United States is not one of them, but 50 other countries have ratified the treaty. That means that under the terms of the treaty, you have to hold what's known as a Conference of States Parties, CSP. In other words, just basically a meeting of all of the nations that have ratified the treaty within the next year. That treaty is going to be held in Mexico in the summer of 2015, probably late June, early July, thereabouts, and preparations are already underway for the CSP. Now, myself and a lot of other treaty skeptics have been participating in this process. I have to say the UN doesn't like it, but we have been participating in the whole treaty process for several years now. Well, unfortunately, Mexico is perhaps the single nation in the world that is most vehemently anti-Second Amendment, and they have always campaigned for an arms trade treaty that would apply explicitly to firearms sales inside the United States under the spurious argument that any handgun ever sold in the United States could at some point end up outside the United States, and therefore our business is always everyone's business. Well, in preparing for this CSP in the summer of 2015, Mexico has made the decision it's going to lock out all the skeptics. So none of the skeptics, myself included, have been allowed to participate in any of the preparatory meetings or conferences that have been held to this date. And when we've applied to enter into these, we've been told explicitly and on the record that meetings are now intended solely for organizations that have taken an active role in promoting the adoption of the treaty. But what you have here is a UN treaty adopted through UN mechanisms where NGOs and, of course, governments are supposed to be allowed equal access, suddenly being turned into a members-only club in Mexico, the single most anti-Second Amendment pro-arms trade treaty nation in the entire world. I don't want to be too skeptical, but nothing good can possibly come out of this.
Needless to say. What can the Congress of the United States do? I understand that there are bipartisan majorities in both the House and Senate in opposition to this treaty for the various reasons you've described, Ted Brauman. Can anything be done under the present circumstances, given the president's disposition and the approach that he's taking at the moment?
Of course. We're only as powerless as we want to be. There are lots of things that can be done. The first thing that can be done is the Congress has regularly passed bans on funding for implementation of the arms trade treaty. Now, because of our broken budget-making process, these bans have not had the kind of effect they should have done. A very simple mechanism would be to, A, pass bans on funding for implementation of the arms trade treaty, and then when the administration goes on record, as it has already done, by saying, we're implementing the arms trade treaty, hold a hearing. Hold the executive branch to account. Summon officials up to Capitol Hill and force them to go on the record in front of congressional committees about why they're implementing a treaty that has not even been sent to the Senate, for which funding has repeatedly been banned, and for which 55 senators have signed a letter explicitly stating that they will oppose the ratification of said treaty. That would be one very useful step.
I would welcome such a hearing. I hope that it will come to pass, Ted Brauman, and if it does, I know it will be as a direct result of your efforts to call for it and expose why it is so urgently needed. But we're going to talk about several other treaties that warrant a similar kind of attention because they too exhibit the hallmarks of this lawfare being waged against us. Ted Brauman, one of the country's preeminent authorities on the subject, more with him straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, we have served our nation as a force in readiness.
Get some rear security.
From combat operations to humanitarian assistance in every corner of the world. No matter where the mission takes us today,
right,
or wherever our country needs us tomorrow, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for each other. For our nation, for us all, the few, the proud, the Marines.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for our final segment in this very special investigative hour spent with Ted Bromond, a country authority, really, a national authority for our country on matters involving international treaties and the kinds of obligations that can be imposed upon us, even at the expense of our constitutional rights, it seems, as a result of the kind of lawfare now being waged by various sorts inside this country and certainly outside, using this kind of extra-constitutional mechanism of treaties to amend, effectively, ours. Ted Bromond, we've talked at some length now about one of the particularly problematic treaties, and you've called for hearings and funding cutoff, and I strongly endorse those. Let's talk about another treaty that the president has also just recently said we will now formally recognize and abide by over the stated objections of the U.S. military. Another case of unilateral disarmament. Talk about the so-called Ottawa Convention and the effect it's having on our anti-personnel landmine capabilities.
Well, as you just implied, Frank, the Ottawa Convention is essentially a ban on anti-personnel landmines. And the popular image of landmines is that they're extremely dangerous, they kill a lot of civilians, they're bad for people's human rights, etc. Well, the U.S., long ago, under President Clinton, and the Senate approved all of this, signed a treaty which made U.S. landmines turn themselves off after a set period, deactivate themselves, so that they couldn't pose any danger to civilians. So U.S. landmines are very, very safe, and they play a very vital military purpose. If you have a camp or a base and you don't want to get overrun by the enemy, if you're guarding a certain area and you want to channel an enemy assault to come into a certain area, you use landmines to do that. If you want to close off a pass to enemy armor and the infantry, you can use landmines to do that. All of those are very useful, very sound, very traditional ways to employ landmines. And U.S. landmines, again, deactivate, turn off in ways that are entirely legal and have been approved by the Senate. Now, what the president said last month was that the U.S. would start abiding, except in the Korean Peninsula, where we use a lot of landmines to stop the North Koreans, would start abiding by the Ottawa Convention and would destroy all of our stocks of landmines that are not needed outside of Korea. This is an extraordinarily irresponsible thing to do, because essentially what the President of the United States has done is make a bet that there will never again in the entire future history of the world be an occasion where there will be any sort of war or conflict where the U.S. will need to protect a base with landmines. There's no way he can know that. And in fact, I think it's a sure thing that there will in future be an occasion when the U.S. has to use these.
Ted, again, I'm just sort of flummoxed by the fact that the military has for years now made clear they believe this is an essential and abiding requirement, that there is, I think you indicated in a recent speech, which people can see, by the way, online at securefreedom.org, an actual NATO study indicating that there's no foreseeable technology that will replace landmines at the moment. And for all these reasons, it does seem like the height of irresponsibility on the part of the president. Again, what can be done about this under the circumstances?
Well, you referred to the NATO study, and that's exactly right. NATO has conducted such a study. The National Research Council has conducted such a study. Just a few months ago, General Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said that landmines were an essential tool in the arsenal of the United States. So there really is no serious debate about this. What can be done? Very, very simple. The president needs to be stopped from destroying this stock of landmines. You can't force the president of the United States to use landmines, but you can preserve the option for a future president of the United States to use them in the kind of responsible way that we've used them in the past. Once the stock of existing landmines is destroyed and we're not making any more, it really doesn't matter if a future president changes his policy and allows the use of landmines if you don't have any actual landmines left in the arsenal. So save the current stocks and preserve the option for a future president to make a better and more responsible decision for the security of the United States.
Ted, we're almost out of time. This hour has flown by, and it's been exceptionally illuminating on so many different scores. I'd like to just very quickly ask you about another agreement, or perhaps treaty, if you will, that is now very much in the works. The president seems determined to secure some kind of deal with Iran, and yet it seems as though the terms that he's prepared to settle for to get such a deal will almost certainly allow the Iranians to have their nuclear weapons. The president has recently indicated that he has no intention of submitting this kind of agreement to the United States Senate for its advice and consent. Talk, if you will, about the substance of it, but specifically about the importance of the Senate being able to advise and consent, as the Constitution says, to so problematic an agreement as this one.
Well, the deal is going to be an absolutely terrible one. It's going to have two components. First, the United States is going to agree to let Iran have lots of nuclear centrifuges, more than it currently has. And second, the United States is going to agree to drop all of its sanctions on Iran. Now, I'm not entirely sure what we get out of that deal. It seems like we're giving them two things and getting nothing back in return. So I'd call that a pretty bad deal. And when you're dealing with Iran, I don't think that's very satisfactory. Now, it's extraordinarily important for the Senate to be able to weigh in on this treaty because it will, in fact, be a treaty. Now, the president and the administration may seek to deny that, but this is going to be a U.S. agreement with a foreign nation that centers around trade on the one hand and arms control issues on the other. This is going to involve a lot of sanctions that have been passed fully through the Congress of the United States. It's going to be about a nation, Iran, where huge majorities of senators and representatives, for that matter, have repeatedly expressed demands that the administration toughen up its policy, not go the other way.
On both sides of the aisle, by the way.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there have been so many senators and reps demanding this that it simply can't only be Republicans. It's very natural the president doesn't want to send this to the Senate because he knows he doesn't have a chance in hell of getting the entire thing agreed to. So he's simply going to try to end run the authority of the Senate by simply implementing the treaty in practice without actually getting Senate advice and consent to it.
Well, they have to stand up against this, the United States Senate, and the lame duck session would be a good point at which to start doing so. Ted Brumman, you mentioned in passing, and we've only got a minute left, but very quickly, the UN Convention on the Rights of the Disabled, your colleague Steve Groves joined us last week and warned that this may be something that will be on the agenda. The administration actually will try to jam through the United States Senate during the lame duck session. Make book on that for us and the advisability of it.
Well, I think it's a very unadvisable idea. We in the U.S. already have the Americans with Disabilities Act, which everyone recognizes is the leading protection in the world for disabled people. We don't need to take lessons from the U.N. on how to treat the disabled. And we certainly don't need to put ourselves under the authority of the kind of international panel that this treaty will create, has created, for them to lecture us about all sorts of sins, almost all of them imaginary, that we have supposedly committed. We have the best standards in the world in this country. What we are going to get from this treaty is a bunch of hectoring, lecturing nonsense from the UN and from progressive organizations about how we're in fact terrible. We've got this already with a lot of other human rights treaties. Why do we need more of this garbage?
I hope the Senate will heed you and Steve Groves on this matter, as well as the larger point you've been making so well, Ted Brumund on lawfare. Dr. Brumund is, again, the Senior Research Fellow in Anglo-American Relations at the Margaret Thatcher Center for Freedom at the Heritage Foundation. Thank you so much for giving us generously of your time, Ted. Come back to us again soon with updates on all of these fronts, if you will. It's vitally important we understand the challenge, and nobody does better than you. I hope the rest of you will join us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.